Welcome back. As you may have noticed for a couple of the sessions now, Professor Klausler has been looking off to his right, and there sits this other person, which happens to be me. My name is Bob Zomerman, and I'm on the faculty here at CLI, and one of the things I like to do with this particular course is to sit in and have some discussion as it's going along. You'll also find that in the other course that we recorded with Professor Klausler. So, my name is Bob, and as we talk back and forth, what we're trying to do is grapple with some of the things that might be kind of an issue for a student to try to grasp and understand. So, here we go. Now, Professor Klausler, if I could use your
sure.
your drawing thing here. It seems to me that one of the things I have noticed to a great extent in my studies with philosophy and so on is that the whole idea that the divine is found somewhere inside of reality
seems
like that's just accepted.
Oh yeah, sure.
But why do we just do that?
Well, I don't think it's just accepted among Christians.
No, but I mean, this is kind of where people work.
That's right. But that's because of the start philosophy got. I mean, there was 600 years of brilliant thinking and theory making and great cultural accomplishments. Right? And the Greeks not only proposed these theories, they used them. They calculated the distance from the Earth to the Sun. They came up with that the Earth went around the Sun centuries before it was rediscovered by Copernicus and Galileo. They developed mathematics. They developed logic. This is really impressive stuff. So Christianity arises. Christian scholar looks at all that and says, "What am I going to say? It's all wrong? No, it isn't all wrong. So how do I explain that they came up with so much truth and so on?" And they are taken in by this schema I had here.
Yeah.
Well, okay, they're wrong in locating the divine as part of the cosmos. It's it's not matter, and it's not logic, and it's not mathematics, and it isn't space, and so on. But then those things may really explain everything else and still not be divine. You come to this scheme that I had here. And so they're pretty... look, many people will go to the wall for this. They love this. They want to keep it. They say, if you junk that, you've got to start all over. And in a way, that's what Doerr is saying. Yes, you need to start all over. It doesn't mean nothing ever happened. We learn a lot from the past theories.
Yeah.
There's progress, even if it's negative. You find out what won't work pretty well as you go along.
So we have God who's outside of reality,
outside of creation.
Outside of the create. He is real.
Yes, not outside reality.
But he's the one that forms the creation, and it's Christ who is
really
the mediator.
Yeah, of the power of God, it's Christ that sustains everything, through whom God created everything, and at every moment it all depends on God through Christ. If God were to withdraw his sustaining power, everything other than God would disappear, like the stuff on your computer screen when you shut it off.
Like you and I would just be gone.
Yes, everything would be
annihilated. So right now, Christ is active in our lives.
Oh, yeah, sure. And everyone's, whether they know it or not,
and
believe
this,
it or not.
And this depends on Christ.
Sure.
It all does.
Sure. But this was very tempting. You can see, you can, as long as your theory doesn't contradict some revealed truth, you're fine. Well, how is somebody going to show that a theory contradicts a revealed truth? Usually, it's really easy to just change a little here and there. Now we don't have a contradiction anymore. We're saying, no, there's a much more profound connection between God and theory making than just altering your language so that we don't have an out-and-out contradiction. That belief in God can actually motivate us or direct us in theory making so that we tend to go down the right path. It won't guarantee we never make a mistake. I'm not saying that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that if you do it the right way, you'll inevitably have the right answer. You can make a hypothesis and delimit it in a way that Christians ought to, and it still be false.
Okay, so I want to just take a hypothesis,
yeah,
and theory,
yeah.
What's the difference?
Probably nothing.
Oh, okay.
Most people are in the habit of using theory to include the observations and other things that led us to make the hypothesis, which we add, and then we draw our conclusion. Some people use them interchangeably.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I kind of thought, but yeah. I thought if we have to keep them straight, now's the time to get them
that's
straight.
Right. As I use them, a hypothesis is a component of a theory. The theory is the wider set
okay.
And the hypotheses are the guesses we make and insert and see that it entails results we know to be the truth or results we experimentally test for if it's an experimental science. A lot of them aren't.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, sure, the math and physics and biology, mm-hmm. we can do that kind of stuff. It's harder when it comes to psych.
Yeah.
And by the time you get to ethics, you're not talking about experiments.
Yeah. We hope.
Yeah. Yes, we do hope.
One of the things, you know, the Greeks were so powerful in terms of the power of their thinking.
That's amazing.
That it held over. Yeah. I mean, this is like 2,600 years now.
Yeah. They're individual geniuses like Archimedes that still boggle your mind.
Yeah.
Toward the end, there are some writings that look as though he invented the calculus. And it was kind of lost, but
yeah.
The guy's amazing. Yeah.
So when they were talking, they lived in a culture that had all these gods.
Yes. Yeah.
How did the philosophers relate to that? Could I have you just tell me a little bit about what you understand on that?
Yeah, there's no one characterization. They related in a lot of different ways, especially in the early going. Anaximander, who recognizes that whatever you regard as the self-existent mm-hmm. generator of everything else is divine. And he didn't believe in any gods. So he gets called an atheist. And he's explaining the nature of religious belief in such a way that one divinity belief or another is going to lie at the foundation of any ontology or epistemology somebody constructs. So he did have that. I did say, and there's a new manuscript, I'm working on a book, and I was discussing this, and I pointed out how different guys held different views, but it seemed to come down, the longer philosophy went on and on for the Greeks, the more and more they were atheists. They became extremely skeptical of the gods and goddesses, until you get... a famous essay, it's called On the Gods. I remember translating this in Greek class. And it starts, it's Protagoras. Concerning the gods, it is impossible to say whether they are or are not. That's the famous opening line. And in the book, I contrast that with the verdict in Israel. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God.
Yeah.
For Israel, that wasn't a hypothesis.
That was a given.
God lived with them.
Yes.
That was part of the national consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very different where you reason and think and explain under faith in God, or you are left to look on your own for how things might be, and you look at those gods and stories about the gods and goddesses that are given by Hesiod and Homer, and the later philosophers say, well, you know, that's kind of fun for kids, but...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we don't think that any of that's real.
So I've been to Greece, and you know they have these temples to Apollo, Athena, and so on. How did the philosophers relate to that?
In a way that's very similar to the way a Brahmin Hindu priest would relate to all the different traditions and gods and goddesses and practices in India. They don't oppose them. They don't say to somebody, stop this, this isn't the truth. The Buddhists do that. The mm-hmm. Hindu won't do mm-hmm. that. What they say is, that's the closest to the truth they can come. That's all the religious insight they had. Not everybody can be a Brahmin. But the real truth is, that's just there to accommodate the average person who can't and isn't prepared to come to the real truth, which is that all of that's illusion. It's all preliminary. And the real truth is that
Brahmanatman is not an individual, not a person. It's by meditation and also by knowledge that we will be absorbed into that and not reborn into another life of suffering.
Yeah.
That's what they believe. So the philosophers took an attitude that was much like that. They usually didn't go up and down saying the gods are all false. That would have brought them in, and that's what got Socrates in trouble when he annoyed enough people sufficiently that they decided to get rid of him. They found a way to charge him with being an atheist, which he wasn't, and he had never said he was. They said, "Well, this and this and this shows that you really are, whether you admit it or not." You know that. According to the practices then, they didn't expect to have to execute him. It was standard practice to be sentenced to death and your family comes and pays the bribe and you go home.
Mm-hmm.
And he wouldn't pay the bribe.
Oh.
Because his friends come and say, what are you doing? Don't you know what they're going to do? If you don't pay the bribe, you know what they're going to do? What? Well, he says, that's the honorable thing. Of course, it's also true that if you had served in the army, and he had, and you were killed, even if the state executed you, your children were cared for life, and they were given a free education and so on.
Oh.
He could have had, and he was pretty old, so he said, maybe it's better I just do this.
Yeah.
Accept the sentence.
Yeah.
A little aside on that. But these guys still impress everybody with the brilliance.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, they also have blind spots, and it has to do with the different divinity beliefs that motivate one thinker or another. And I'm so sorry that Christians coming along didn't see the downfall in that move.
Mm-hmm.
In the Western Church, they go right ahead, they accept that move. And the Eastern Church did not. I think they were right to reject that. And I mentioned before and in the other course how Calvin, especially Luther and Calvin, at the time of the Reformation, rediscovered the Orthodox view. Whether they did that by reading Orthodox thinkers or not, I can't. I've been trying to find out, and I haven't been able to find out. But at any rate, they did. So Calvin says, look, the grace of Christ, he's saying, in effect, it's not just upstairs in that house. It's not just supernatural. Mm-hmm. The grace of Christ permeates all reality, and all our understanding is nothing unless it's brought in captivity to Christ. He quotes that from St. Paul. So he was clear about not buying into that move.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just one more question here. As you were talking, it reminded me in Acts 17 when Paul shows up in Athens, where all these people are gathered together to hear what was new.
That's right.
It sounds like a typical university,
oh,
right?
Yeah. That's what it was, the public debating spot.
Yeah.
And Luke says these guys spend all their time just to hear her tell of something new. It's a down-to-earth observation.
Yeah, and then Paul stands on the Areopagus and says, something about the gods do not dwell in temples made by human hands.
Yeah, he has a clever start. He starts by saying, on my way here today, I noticed an altar dedicated to the unknown god.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, that was Greek way of covering your bases. In case we miss somebody, we'll have one that...
Yeah.
Okay. And he says, I've come to tell you about that God. And that's the one that created the heavens and the earth and everything in them. They didn't have any God like that, see?
Yeah.
So right away, they're put off. The heavens, the earth, that created everything? Come on, a God can't do that. A God's just a being with more divinity in him than a human. No, this is the only God, the God that created the heavens and the earth and everything in them. And when he gets done, what they say in Greek is, who's this seed picker?
Because he starts talking about resurrection.
Yeah.
You know,
who's the hayseed that doesn't even know that the gods can't control death?
Yeah.
But he was speaking of the true God who does and raised Christ from the dead. And that's what he said. Again, that's why they call him a seed picker.
Yeah. And so Paul was kind of calling into question this thing when he was standing there at the Areopagus. Is that?
Yeah, sure.
He was saying, you know, your gods are...
That's right.
You know, the God I'm declaring to you actually has made everything.
Yeah.
And so when you're talking about these gods and so on... If they might even be real, which they're not, but they'd still be creatures of this God I'm declaring to you.
Yeah, that's right. So not, if you put what he says there together with Colossians 1, mm-hmm. it really looks like he's saying no you to this.
Yeah.
Yeah, there, yeah. It's, so it's not only, I'll repeat this one again, it's not only that no part of the cosmos is self-existent and is what everything else depends on. No part of the cosmos is what everything else depends on, whether it's self-existent or not. It's not that God created form and matter, and form and matter generate everything else. Mm-hmm. It's that it all directly depends on God, and the only mediator is Jesus Christ mm-hmm. in his divine nature. Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.